Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Too Hot to Handle, Enabling Efficient Thermal Management in Military Electronics. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Dennis Smith, Vice President of Engineering for Temis Computer, and David Hinkle, Senior Applications Engineer, Embedded Computing Products with Elma Electronic. With more than 43 years of experience in high-performance computer systems and peripheral development, Dennis Smith has mentioned as the current Vice President of Engineering for Temis Computer, where he oversees all hardware, software, and mechanical development for the Temis product line. Prior to Temis, he worked 2.5 years as the Director of Hardware Development for NetFrame and 7 years as the Development Manager at Sun Microsystems. David Hinkle has more than 30 years of experience in the embedded computing industry, where he has architected and designed integrated systems in the military and aerospace, telecom, and industrial automation markets based on open architectures such as VME, Compact PCI, and now OpenVPX and ComExpress. He is Elma's resident system expert at OpenVPX designs. Now, before we get started, I have some housekeeping announcements. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Today's eCast will consume about 40 to 45 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer sessions. Now I want to point out some important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. Use the Download Slide button to view the slides as a PDF to see them larger. The second important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. The third button on your console window allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I'll hand out the questions equally to our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be archived online and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. And now I'm pleased to turn over to our first speaker, David Hinkle. David?
Thank you, John. Okay. What I want to talk about is thermal from a perspective of from the whole system, the solution. And what we're finding in the industry today is that, as we all know, we're putting 10 pounds in a 5-pound box, and that is because we have so many things that are changing so rapidly. We're getting higher density in a PCB. We're putting a lot more server-grade or FPGA-type chips on systems. And these things, are, you know, we're putting them on smaller cards, you know, 3U type of cards, and the push is to go swap. Get it smaller, get it smaller. So as we get more and more in the box, right, understanding how to get the heat out of the box becomes a very important thing. And so we're going to talk about some of the things that we do that are key challenges to us as we go through this. A lot of different ways you can cool something down. So we're going to talk about some of the basic things. Obviously, heat sinks, most of us are familiar with that. And we can deal with that pretty easily. We also have, at the card level, getting down to the lower level, ways in which we can deal with getting thermal off of a board that's inside of a chassis, or going down even further, having the kinds of materials that you would need to help get the heat out of that board so we can get it over to an edge or get it over to some other area. At the box level, we can do things like fans, all right, or fins, and we can liquid cool things. So there's a lot of ways in which we can bring these things out, either from the low level and moving up the chain, and you put it in a box, and the box can give you capabilities to bring things out. Well, one of the things sometimes we forget about is that when you talk about a solution, you need to take it all the way to the top, all right? Where's it going to go? All right, are you going to rack it in something? And if you are, there are solutions that you can provide to assist you in how you get the heat out. All right, again, we can have just standard venting type of strategies, or we can have air conditioning type of units we can put into these, or we can actually have liquid flow through as well into the larger rack mount type of solution. So it's not just about getting the heat off of the little board at the inside. You take it all the way up to the top when you're dealing with a solution on it. Okay, again, going back on some of the convection, some of the methodologies for cooling. You know, convection and air, that's pretty much mostly heat exchangers and fans, right? Air conditioners where your ambient temperatures are down. But one thing I want to point out there is there are strategies that you can use. For instance, you can take a fully enclosed box and have the conduction cooling to bring the thermal out to the side and then have a fan that pulls that heat off of the side. So you're not actually touching the boards internally. So environmentally, you're not exposing any of the airflow to the internal payload, but you're cooling the outside of the box with a fan. All right. So it doesn't have to be one or the other. You can combine both of those to achieve your solution. And again, you need to understand how it's going to be used. Conduction cooling, of course, you know, that's passive at this point in time. And there are a lot of ways that we can get at that using fins and cold plates and things of that nature. Knowing, again, how we're going to implement this becomes very important. Right? And liquid cooling, nothing like a cold fluid running through to help us cool things down. Okay, again, this is probably reiterating a little bit of what I just said, but this sort of talks about it from a perspective of when do you choose which, all right? If you are in a situation where you can, air cooling is probably your most economical, all right? But it has some downsides. Fans are very noisy. Fans break down, all right? But it is the lowest cost solution in most cases because you don't have to put a lot of effort into the overall mechanics of the enclosures. You just put enough airflow over it and you're good. All right. When you go up to the next level, the conduction cooling, again, this is where you have environmental situations where you need to consider where airflow from a contaminated environment is something you would not put over your payload. Right? We need to get into designing the use of the space. I mean, often we don't have room for a lot of these big fans and all these other things. We're getting into a confined space. So at this point in time, we have to give up those kinds of things. And the conduction cooling, you normally have fewer parts that are moving, which is very important, obviously, as you get into a reliability situation. Right? And last but not least, the most expensive of these are going to be a liquid. Right? And you're going to choose that in a situation where you're in extreme environments where you absolutely need to control your environment, and you will have capabilities of doing that from there. Okay. Small form factor. It's a new buzzword that I keep hearing. You know, being an old guy, I've been hearing this stuff for a long time. But small form factor, putting more and more into smaller and smaller boxes. The challenge, obviously, is getting the heat out, all right? Because this is a very dense space. There's not a lot of room in there for things. And where you put things inside the box makes a difference, whether you put the heat source up, heat source down. How are you going to mount a box? Are you going to mount it horizontally, vertically? Because that takes into consideration how you're going to put your fins in terms of where the normal airflow will move. So there's a lot of things that have to be taken into consideration and a lot of variability. It's not generally a one-box-fix-all. You need to understand how it's going to be used, how it's going to be mounted, and we go from there. So this is becoming very challenging in our space as we move into smaller and smaller boxes. Back again, though, a lot of the business out there that we're all living in the military space, we have a lot of rack mount things. So it's not all these little boxes. You know, there's still a good amount of things that we are putting on ships and planes and things of this nature that are in racks. and they need to be controlled and monitored and dealt with appropriately. So being able to understand what the options are and how you can approach a solution, a total solution, and where is the best place to put your cooling strategies, you know, at the board level, at the box level, at the rack level. Again, it all depends on the solution that you need to deal with, right? And so, you know, keep in mind when you're looking at a solution, how it's going to be implemented. I can't stress this as an engineer that works out in the field. Early, the more activity you have in terms of working with a solution and understanding how it's going to be used, the better off you're going to be in your thermal designs. All right. So I'm always anxious to work with customers who will start off with an idea and then we'll design a solution for that idea rather than saying, how do you cool off something that's already hot? All right. So we have to look at all the pieces and develop them as a team, all right, to get to a solution that we want. Again, physical concepts. I mean, we got to get down to reality, all right? We got to understand that what we're implementing and what pieces we're putting into the puzzle. You know, removing the heat and how you remove the heat starts at the bottom and goes all the way to the top. Generally, you're going to have a lot of iterations in there. And as we all know, is everybody wants to add a little something once we get started on it, and then, oh, yeah, I forgot to add this hot piece. Right, so we need to be flexible and have the ability to change. So, again, partnering with the right partners is very, very important when we get into the embedded space now as we're dealing with these thermal issues. You don't want to just assume that you buy something off the shelf and it works. You need to work with somebody who understands how to get these types of things out. And you want to reduce your risk of the overall project, not just what it would take. Okay, this is sort of a 10,000-foot view. I'm going to turn this back to John now, and we can get some deeper decisions and discussions going forward. You there, John?
My apologies, I was on the mute button. Thank you again, David. Excellent presentation. I want to remind the audience before we transition to our next speaker that we have these two experts on for the end of the webinar for Q&A that you'll never have time like that again. So please get your questions ready. Start sending them in now. We will get to them as soon as our next speaker, Dennis Smith, is finished with his presentation. Dennis, I'm turning it over to you.
Okay, thanks, John. I'm going to be talking about a number of things on the thermal side. It's primarily focused on rack mount systems, and we find that over the years, a lot of our customers have transitioned from VME-based and card-based systems over to rack mount standard 1U, 2U, 3U systems for their application space. As we go and into the future, we find that, in fact, it's very important to be able to accommodate different types of technology into a rack mount system type, whether it's 1U, 2U, 3U. And we'll talk about that in the next few slides. So everybody operates in a multi-constraint environment. You've got connectivity, you've got power, you've got shock and vibration, you've got thermal, acoustics, size and weight. And all of these things interoperate within the system that needs to be delivered to the customer. If you're trying to do a thermal design, a lot of cases, you have to take into account the vibration, shock, and size, weight, and types of input in order to be able to come up with a final solution. In a lot of cases, we find that the final application requires that the solution be very quiet, and so acoustics enter into the equation as well, not only airborne acoustics, but also structure-borne acoustics because of the application type. You need to look at all of these different variables when you go through and come up with a thermal solution. So the factors that affect cooling efficiency, David hit on a lot of these things, but at the component level, you've got things like power differences between the different devices. You've got temperature gradients across the packages that you have to take into account. You've got preheating of downstream devices, and in fact, a lot of the design challenges are related to trying to not only cool the initial devices in the air path, but also after that's done, you may in fact have some downstream devices that have got preheat as a result of pulling heat out of devices that are on the upstream path. Certainly, device package materials enter into the equation as well. Some devices may in fact have plastic type packages, whereas other devices have got integrated heat spreaders that are typically metallic and provide resistance into the thermal path that you wouldn't normally see in a device that has got, a device die that's directly exposed to the cooling solution. And then, of course, as I said, the device thermal coupling is a big thing. So heat spreading is a big constraint, especially in the higher power devices that we come into with things like Xeon processors and stuff, where you can see 100 plus watts of power being dissipated out of a package that's less than 40 millimeters on a side. So those are the things that you have to look at and take into account on the component side. And the mechanical constraint side, of course, ideally you'd like to be able to have a clean path between the inlet and to the device that you're actually trying to provide cooling to. But a lot of times you don't have that opportunity, so you have to take into account cables, things that disturb the airflow, so like cables, inlet filters, venting, inlet exhaust restrictions, and those types of things that get into the air path and give you a less than ideal air solution to whatever you're trying to cool. And then, of course, there's a trade-off between free air versus forced convection. Typically, the higher power devices, you provide a forced air convection solution to, whereas the free air devices, those devices that are not directly into the forced air path, still dissipate heat, and you have to take those things into consideration when you're trying to provide a cooling solution. And then finally, the environmental conditions. You just don't have really good airflow a lot of times. You'll have a rack mount system that is installed in a rack, and the first thing the airflow encounters is perhaps either a filter that's on a door or perhaps the door itself that's not located far enough away to provide a good air path in. And so you end up having poor uneven airflow because of this the inlet. And then you've got the temperature flux that you have to deal with. So the desert and the sun are going to be providing hot inlets, whereas airplanes are typically on the cold side, especially if it's pressurized. But you also have to take into account things like high altitude. So if you're going to be providing a cooling solution that's in a pressurized cabin, you also have to take in consideration what that cooling solution is going to do when all of a sudden the cabin is going through decompression, okay, due to an air leak in the airframe. So those are the things that you have to look at in the environmental side. So as David indicated, there's a lot of different system cooling methods. So, you know, you get free convection, which typically are used for lower power applications. But in the case of rack mount systems, they're actually inside of the enclosure. Things like third-party cards that don't have direct air passage to the card itself. Chipsets that are on the motherboard and devices that are not directly forced air cooled are things that you have to look at from a free convection standpoint. Forced air cooling, which happens to be, as David indicated, the most cost effective and currently is used for cooling high power devices, are things that is a method that is used. And in conjunction with that, on the conduction side, you still need to get the heat out of the device that's trying to be cooled. Okay, so in the case of a processor, you typically have got a case temperature, maximum case temperature that needs to be managed. And so you typically will operate and provide some type of either heat pipe or vapor chamber type of conduction so that you can keep the path loss as small as possible. Once you get to the heat sink, and then it's the job of the heat sink to provide the method of getting the heat out to the airstream. And then there's other more exotic approaches. Peltier cooling is essentially solid-state refrigeration is something that has been used, although our customers typically don't like that solution because of the failure mode. If you have a failure mode that's in the Peltier cooler, then you are faced with a problem trying to get the heat out of the device that the Peltier cooler is in contact with. And then you keep on going down even further, you have synthetic jet, electrostatic, and liquid cool stuff. Temis has actually done a system, provided a solution to a customer with liquid cooling on it, and it's been a flow-through cooling type of solution. The biggest problem we had there is not so much in the electronics that we have trying to be cooled, but in the fact that the operating fluid itself is faced with, you have to worry about things like contamination where you end up getting clogged cooling tubes and you have to periodically go out and clean that stuff out. But in fact, gets into the middle of trying to properly cool a system. And then finally, spray cooling. And spray cooling is great for real high power. But you need an inert fluid, okay? You need something that, in fact, can operate directly on a device and can make contact with a printed circuit board but does not cause conduction, and you need to have some kind of floor inert that you can use for the working fluid for spray cooling. So I'm going to focus on the air forced air cooling method because, in fact, like I said, that's the most economical and provides, and today is actually widely used. And, in fact, there's a lot of work on trying to improve the efficiency of all of the devices that are in the path from the heat-generating device out to the airstream. So, you know, typically what you find in a forced air cooled solution is cooling fans. I mean, it's a simple thing of just trying to increase the amount of airflow past the device that you want to cool, and you do that through a heat sink that basically exposes as much surface as possible so that you can provide as much cooling efficiency as you can to the device that needs to be cooled. So, you know, typically fans, at least in our designs, are designed and chosen to be able to provide cooling for 150 to 100 watts, in some cases even higher than 100 watts heat sources. And as you probably know, anybody that's really done thermal design work, forced air cooling provides much better heat transfer compared to free air convection, and in some cases it's could be up as high as maybe 10 or 15 times more efficient than doing something through just simply free air convection. So on the mechanical design side, you know, the name of the game is reduce the pressure drop in the path, okay, between the fan itself and its device that needs to be cooled. So, you know, and again, the biggest thing that you want to do, because in fact, it turns out that the heat transfer efficiency is the worst between the actual device heat sink and the airflow and the airstream itself. So you want to try to provide as much coupling as you can between the heat source and the air that's being used to cool it. And for forced air flow, you always want to try to duct the air as much as possible because ducted air provides a much better coupling efficiency than, in fact, if you have airflow that just simply goes over the heat sink outside because of the bypass. And so you don't really get good coupling without having ducted air. And then finally, you want to try to minimize inlet and exhaust restrictions because the higher the pressure drop that you have, and there'll be, you know, a slide that talks a little bit more about the managing the air path. But the you want to try to minimize that because, in fact, what happens is the fan becomes less efficient when, in fact, you and the airflow volume actually gets lower if, in fact, you add more restrictions in the path. So the next thing is basically heat sink selection. I mean, that's the first element that's in the path between the actual device that needs to be cooled and the airstream. So the first thing you want to do is to try to optimize the spreading and the coupling of the heat into the airstream, okay? And that's done by a combination of fin design, number of fins, the fin spacing, the fin height, not only that, but also the width of the fin, because one of the things you want to do is to reduce the pressure drop and keep the Reynolds numbers as low as possible through the heat sink, because the higher the Reynolds numbers in the area of the heat sink, the worse the heat transfer. And then you want to reduce the heat source path thermal resistance as much as possible. And a lot of times you'll find that even the coupling between the heat sink and its device can be an area where you could actually gain a lot and try to reduce the amount of temperature rise to the heat sink. You want to try to select proper air coupling geometries. You know, there's fin, there is pin devices, there is also elliptical type of fins. So the shape is actually important as well. And there are trade-offs between each one of those depending on the airstream itself and how the air is applied to the heat sink. And then, of course, I said, the coupling, you also want to try to provide as much heat spreading as you can by utilizing heat pipes or high conductivity materials such as copper. The idea is to try to spread the heat as much as possible out to all of the fins on the heat sink. And then finally, there is a trade-off in heat sink material for environmental factors. So you've got to worry about weight and shock and vibration. And so in some cases, you might think that, in fact, an all-copper solution, which happens to be the most efficient in trying to move the heat out, might, in fact, work. But, in fact, because of perhaps the weight of the solution, it doesn't work when the actual system is under shock and vibration. You might have to back off a little bit to a different material, perhaps using aluminum on the fins and copper on the base or vapor chamber or heat pipes in order to try to provide a lower weight solution to the system when you have to worry about shock and vibration. So managing the air path, and as you can see on the right, there's a graph here that talks about the system resistance versus the fan curves. And so you want to try to optimize the solution to provide the best match between the fans that are being, or fan or fans that are being used in the system and the actual system resistance. So as you can see there, it's basically where they put the fans and selecting the fan curves, they've basically put the operating point right in the middle of the fan curve. And that provides the most efficient solution in trying to cool a particular device using a heat sink with coupled air. So the other thing that you want to do is keep the air path as straight as possible. Anytime you put a bend or a right angle or even a reverse in an air path, you reduce the actual delivered airspeed. Number one, you've increased the system of resistance. Number two, and you've put the operation of the on the fan curve down at the lower speed, where in fact, or the lower airflow, where in fact, you don't have efficient coupling into the air from the heat sink. And as I said, you want to match the fan performance to the path resistance. And as everything else, you want to minimize the inlet and exhaust air resistance. And then also you want to account for inlet filters. A lot of our solutions have got filters in the airstream. And they're there to provide, removal of dust and particles in the airstream from getting inside of the enclosure. But in fact, because in fact they do their job really well, they also have a side effect of providing a pressure drop or adding resistance into the air path. So you go through all of this effort and you do all this stuff, and you know, what kinds of things can you expect to do? So in our case, we basically go into all of the operations that that I've outlined in the slides before. You can expect to see some reduction of inlet to exhaust temperature rise of about 5 degrees C over what would normally be done in a commercial sense. And you have to remember that commercial systems typically have got maximum operating temperatures up to maybe 35 degrees, in some cases 40 degrees C for commercial operations. And typically in the enterprise area, they're operating in environments that don't get above 30 degrees C, most of them around 25. The other thing that you get to do is support higher speed and core count processors. So if you can reduce the temperature that the device is seeing by applying the methods that I described in the previous slides, you get to select even higher power and higher core count speed processors. And then in addition to reducing the inlet exhaust temperatures, we see a reduction typically of around 5 C or greater at about 100 watts just by applying those types of methods that I described in the previous slides. And finally, what happens also is that you improve system reliability at high temperature. Usually reliability numbers are calculated at 25 degrees C, and they're usually specced out at that rate. But in fact, it's still important, especially if you see systems that are going to be used in elevated temperature environments, that in fact you try to optimize as much as you can the thermal reduction, because you want to try to improve the system reliability at high temperature. So this is the slide that talks about all the different types of systems that we've done. I focused primarily on the rack mount systems on the left, but a lot of the stuff that you see and apply to rack mount systems can also be applied to the smaller form factor stuff. We have small form factor nano packs that go down to the size of a pack of cigarettes, and we got switches that are about the size of a piece of paper. But all the thermal techniques that you do for forced air cooling are still applicable, especially in the connection path, to the smaller form factor things. We've got a couple of case studies that we've done. I didn't really talk about GPU type of applications, but in fact, we're finding that GPUs are the highest power generator and highest heat generators within the system. And you can see GPUs getting up to the 300-watt level. Believe it or not, those devices, even though they've got heat sinks that have been designed, heat devices, they have got they're optimized for commercial operations. So what we try to do is to add additional cooling into the path so that we can extend the temperature of GPUs well beyond their rated spec. Typically, you'll find NVIDIA GPUs are rated up to 45 degrees C with a 20 CFM airflow. And we provide additional airflow in there so that, in fact, we can try to boost the operating temperature up to 50 degrees C, because in fact a lot of our customers have requirements where they have a maximum operating temperature of 50 C. The other thing is, you've got you have to worry about, and I didn't really talk about this, but memory is another area that you really have to worry about, because even though the devices themselves are packaged up on DIMMs, you also have to make sure that you manage the airflow path through the DIMMs, and that's true on any of the rack mount systems designs. And on the right, you've got to worry about the processors and all that sort of stuff. So that's a rack mount, standard rack mount solution. In this case, this is a high density solution. So what we've done is we've taken what would normally be packaged up in a 1U enclosure rack mount, and we have doubled the density. Unfortunately, the power that is being consumed and generated inside of each one of these modules is approximately the same as what you would see in a full rack mount solution. So the density is doubled, but you still have to cool the same amount of equipment, and you still have to worry about the same type of power dissipation from the devices internally. So what we have to do here is pay a lot more attention to trying to reduce the path resistance between the device and the heat sink. You also have to worry about the heat rise from one device to the next device, because in fact both processors are in line. So you have to design the heat sink such that the second device actually has got improved heat air coupling compared to the first device. And at the same time, you also have to reduce the pressure drop on the second device, because in fact you don't want to impede the airflow through the first device. So that's basically all I've got, and I'm going to pass it back to John. Take it away, John.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Outstanding presentation. And so get those questions coming in as we start the Q&A. My first question is for Dennis Smith. How are the thermal requirements for the military different than those for commercial applications?
Okay, so typically in the commercial application, they design a system around a particular capability or standard that they're trying to hit. And they don't have as many constraints such as shock vibe, size, weight, and power that you would see in a military application. Especially in areas such as the Army, where in fact they mount systems into trucks or perhaps put them in transit cases, and the transit cases solutions are being used in tents. In the case of the enterprise, you've got, number one, you've got floor space that is variable, so that in fact your enclosure can grow. Number two, you don't have to hit as high an operating temperature is in the military space, because in fact most of the systems are in an air-conditioned environment, or at least in an environment where in fact there are a lot more there's a lot more room to get the heat out of the system.
Dennis, isn't there some that like oil and gas and that have similar requirements too?
Yeah, oil and gas is I would classify that in similar to military. Now, in the case of oil and gas, they don't have to worry so much about shock and vibration, but operating temperatures, because in fact you're not being placed into a air-conditioned environment, you still have to worry about the getting the heat out, and the operating temperatures are still quite high. And also, because of limited space on things like oil rigs or in trucks, you still have the constraint of size that you have to hit.
Okay. Next question from the audience was sent for Dennis, but I think David can answer this one too. What issues do you see or expect to see more often in new computer systems? Basically, is it getting easier or harder to manage the heat? Dennis, you go first, and then if you won't mind, David, step in too.
Okay.
Can you repeat that question again?
Absolutely. What issues do you see or expect to see more often in new computer systems? Is it getting easier or harder to manage heat?
I think it's actually getting more difficult, and the reason why that's the case is because power levels are going up, and in fact we see that in spite of all the efforts that are being done by the processor manufacturers and perhaps even in the case of GPUs or FPGAs, that power level continues to escalate up. And so it becomes more difficult to get the heat out. The other problem is that a lot of the devices that are coming out are designed for commercial applications, and it's, as such, they've been optimized, at least at the case level, for the commercial operating temperatures. So, you know, it's getting increasingly tough to try to manage a thermal solution because, in fact, the maximum case temperatures are dropping and the heat density is going up.
What do you see, David? Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah, I agree with what Dennis is saying, is that, you know, it's definitely getting more difficult. From our perspective at ELMA, we have we like to deal with open standards and open vendor products that we can mix and match. So each vendor has their own methodology and solutions, if you will, in terms of how they may have created their particular board or subsystem that we use. So it becomes almost what I call a semi-custom type or semi-COTS type of thing, where you're going to always be forced to deal with what you have versus being able to go back and influence the original design. So it is becoming more challenging, especially as we get into smaller space.
Okay. Thank you both. Next question is for David Hinkle. Speaking of open standards and things like that, are your thermal management designs mostly COTS, or is this the area most often customized when you deal with your military customers, the thermal management challenge?
I think it's most often customized. Right, because of what I said earlier, where we take many different vendor best-in-class type of parts and pieces and put them together to form an overall solution for the customer. And then it requires a custom methodology. I mean, we have a chassis has custom heat pipe designs for a specific board from a specific vendor. And if I went to somebody else's vendor, it might not be the case. So we are always constantly re-evaluating the military solutions because they are generally becoming more complex on the thermal.
Okay. All right. This one's for Dennis. Temis was a primary driver of the Vita 74 small form factor standard. How is that standard accommodated for the thermal challenges associated with smaller designs?
Okay. Well, the Vita 74 was conceived at a level that provides an efficient way of getting the heat out from individual modules to the outside. And our approach is basically to try to make everything conductively cooled inside of the main enclosure. And so you can try to reduce as much as possible the heat loss through the, from the modules all the way out to the outside. And you know it's a trade-off because in fact these are pluggable modules that in fact you need to be able to still plug the modules in and out, but at the same time you try to remove as much heat as possible into the external air. Now the enclosure design, of course, not really addressed by Vita 74, but in fact if you think through it a little bit. The optimal enclosure design actually provides a conduction path down to a cold wall or a cold plate, as opposed to trying to extract air out either through free air convection or forced air convection. But the idea is that, in fact, you can design the enclosure such that you can customize the method of coupling, whether it's into the airstream or it's actually to a cold wall, try to optimize the result.
Okay. Speaking of Vita, what are some military applications where Vita 74 is being designed in today? Unmanned systems, others?
Well, definitely unmanned systems, we're finding Vita 74 type of modules and systems are being used for areas like helicopters and aircraft. It's going into applications where, in fact, the form factor and the capability needs to be reduced in size as replacement for things like HAF-ATR, and especially in areas where, in fact, the size is a critical area, but you still need to get the same level of functionality that you would see in a HAF-ATR solution.
Next question from the audience. Are you aware, and this is for both of you to take a shot at, we'll start with David. Are you aware of any new or emerging technologies to assist with small area cooling issues? You know, speaking of small stuff. David?
I'm not. So I'm going to let Dennis see if he can speak to that.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's the area that, especially in the small form factor area, I mean, the physics are the physics, you know, and so unfortunately, you don't get to work around the physics. What you get to do, though, is you get to optimize the method of reducing the heat loss in the path to where the final heat dissipation is. I know that from a chemist standpoint, we've looked at a lot of different types of materials, including hybrid ceramics carbon fiber and a lot of other types of operation heat pipes and stuff, but you know you don't get it's a very small amount of gain in using different types of materials. So like David said, you know there are no silver bullets out there right now, and I know there's a lot of research in trying to get the try to get materials try to help out in trying to solve some of this stuff. Of course, there's always the exotic materials like diamonds, okay, or things that approach diamond types of heat spreading or transfer, but, you know, it's very costly. So, you know, we're sort of stuck with the types of solutions we have today.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis. Next question I have. Is for David Hinkle. Regarding open standards, Army CERDEC is now a member of the VITA Standards Organization. How has that relationship helped suppliers not only with standards development but also solving thermal management challenges? I think Emma was involved in that heavily with us.
Yeah, heavily involved in that. And, you know, the standards sometimes really don't get into some of the things that CERDEC's looking at right now relative to the thermal. I mean, it's definitely considered and part of it, but we're more on dealing with the how they're going to bring the radio systems and things of this nature together into a single vehicle and using a standard open architecture, and you have to deal with, you know, the red and black zones of a solution that the military would use. So having them coming into the standard and helping us define the best architecture topology-wise in terms of how to put together a backplane in a VPX world to solve that. And again, we did try to take into consideration placement of various slot elements to help from a thermal perspective, but it was more about the system solution of getting the radios and getting the MORA type standard implemented through the use of VITA.
Do you see more participation? I've noticed a number of different initiatives coming out through the DoD to work more closely with standards development. Do you see that increasing and obviously helping you guys
a little bit? Absolutely. I think that the recognition by the services that they need to take advantage of the standards, not from a trailing but from a leading situation where they can help drive the standards to help their overall solutions rather than just always calling out that it has to be one of these standards.
Okay. Thank you. Next question is for everyone. I'd like to take a shot at it. Even though the military is not a big market for FPGA and processor companies such as Xilinx and Intel, have the new designs or roadmaps have more power-saving or thermal reduction characteristics, or are you guys still at their mercy and this is really a problem you have to solve for the military when designing those chips in? Dennis?
Well, let me take a
go ahead, David.
Swing from our side here. the military guys are, you know, I, they're using more and more FPGA capabilities as we get into the sensor space and things of this nature. So, and the GPUs are becoming much more of an issue. But I think that the chip manufacturers are helping us. So it's not all on our shoulders that we have to solve all the problems. I mean, Intel is continually moving down and coming up with lower wattage chips that with more cores and whatnot. And the same thing with the FPGA. We're getting more efficient designs coming out that assist this. But again, you know, every time they come out with an efficient design, they add more things to it and they take it away. But at the end of the day, I think they're helping us by helping them manage their heat dissipation out of the chips that they're designing.
Okay. Dennis, do you want to comment at all or add anything to that?
Yeah, well, you know, this is it's a double-edged sword. The problem is that as the die geometries shrink, okay, and the transistor geometries, there's more transistors to throw at applications. And so I'm not so sure. I believe that any of the semiconductor vendors, whether it's FPGA or standard product vendors like Intel, they're going to always find ways of using all those transistors. And unfortunately, what that causes is heat rise. And then as a result of the speeds going up, and in fact, there is a, you know, even though there was a short hiatus on the actual maximum operating speeds, you know, clock speeds, now it seems like there is an escalation of clock speeds up. And unfortunately, the problem occurs, and as a result of going to higher speeds is that the devices themselves have higher leakage. And that's basically, you know, unused or unrealized heat that you know, everybody gets. And no matter what you do to try to manage the power actively, you know, the actual leakage current and leakage power is escalating up as the speeds get higher and higher and you have more transistors.
Along those lines, and some of this might have been answered about what you both just talked about, a question just came in asking about, in the case of upcoming FPGA accelerators, someone would expect that the power and heat will be reduced in these accelerators. Why do you expect the heat will rise up in upcoming new compute systems, FPGAs and HPC? Is there anything you want to add that you already said, or has that kind of already been answered?
Do you want to take a crack at it, David?
Well, I think we both sort of hinted at it, and I'll try it again. You know, even though they are reducing all these things because of the they're shrinking them down, and now they're putting more in it, and so they give it and then they take it away, and so we're still and the net is that we're managing a lot of the issue of how to get this heat out, but we're sort of managing it as they continue to grow and it keeps a straight line.
Okay. Anything to add to that, Dennis, or are you?
Yeah. You know, the problem is our customers are always driving to the top end. So they want the maximum number of cores, the highest speed processors, you know, the highest capability GPUs. We haven't really gotten too much into the FPGAs yet, at least at the rack level. But, you know, we see the trend as being, you know, the customer still wants to have as much as they can get for their particular application. And in a lot of cases, especially in the case of GPUs, where in fact, you know, the cooling design is already sort of baked because of the way that, you know, it's been done by at the card level by the by NVIDIA or even Intel, our customers still want to operate those devices at the higher speeds, and not the higher speeds, but the higher temperatures. And in some cases, they could go upwards of maybe 10 degrees C over the spec of the cards. So, you know, this is the problem that we're faced with. And, you know, they want all the stuff that's available in the commercial world as COTS devices, but basically tailored to their environment.
Okay. Thank you both. Next question is asked to Dennis, but I think it'd be a good question to have answered by both of you as we kind of get close to the end of the webinar. What has been the most challenging thermal problem you've encountered, Dennis?
No, liquid cooling. Well, hands down, that's been the biggest challenge for us. And it's not so much in the actual design part of the coupling of, you know, devices to the cold plate, which we've done. But things like that you wouldn't think about would be a problem. Things like dripless couplers, where you have to remove a blade and you have to disconnect from the water source and it's under pressure. And the couplers, the coupler design is really, really critical, and matching it up and mating up the coupler is really critical. And then I think, as I mentioned before, the other thing is contaminants in the water stream. Okay, and making something such that contaminants can proliferate, but in fact doesn't cause over time a significant degradation in the cooling performance of the system. So I'd have to say liquid cooling is probably the biggest challenge that we've had.
Is there an issue at all with liquid or spray cooling in airborne applications as well? Is that some challenges there with vibration, shock, and vibe affecting the way it's set up, the architecture of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a challenge because, especially in aircraft, because of the G-forces that are applied to the system. So you've got to be able to manage not only that, but also things like the angle that the aircraft is at, and you got to be able to handle all that stuff. And then finally, you have to be able to support the decompression in the case of losing pressure in the cabin itself.
Okay. David, what's been your most challenging thermal management problem that you've solved?
Well, I'm going to have to agree with Dennis that, the liquid is definitely the most challenging. And I think probably, to give it a bigger picture type thing is, it is that it is so custom, right? There's no one fits all, right? When you get into the liquid, it's a custom solution for the customer, and if we make changes, it's almost starting over.
Okay. And we're getting ready to go here, but one question for you both. Are there any upcoming trade shows or industry events where our audience can come see Temis Computer or Elma Electronics thermal management solutions?
Sure. There's the NVIDIA conference that I believe is next week, and you'll be able to come and see Temis Solutions there. It's called the GTC, and if you haven't registered already, you could probably go there and get in, but that would be sort of the near-term place where you can see our equipment and specifically systems that have got GPU solutions integrated in there.
Yeah, I know, and I can say from Elma's perspective, we're going to be down at the AUVSI in Dallas, so you can see us down there and talk to us about some of the things that we have there as well.
Now called Exponential. And as we leave, and the NVIDIA conference, real quick, is follow-up, that's in Silicon Valley, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you both for speaking today. We have now reached our time limit. Sorry we cannot get to all of your questions. Someone may get back to you after the ECAS with more information. I'd like to thank Dennis Smith and David Hinkle for speaking today, and Temis Computer, Elma Electronics, and National Instruments for sponsoring the event. Please remember that this and all Open Systems MediaCast are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. This ECAS will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. I thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media ECAS. Goodbye.